Hi everyone, we're just going to start in 1 minute. All right, so another few seconds, we'll begin. All right, good evening everyone, watching on Zoom and, excuse me, and on Facebook. I hope you're all doing okay under the circumstances. So tonight is a little bit more of a sadder topic, maybe a more morbid topic, but it's an important topic. And it's about mourning and the process of mourning and the process of grief. But I want to do this in, this is the schmooze, this is not just a lecture, so we try and do this a little more in a personal way and sort of have more of a conversation and to understand how this all works. So I want to do this more in a personal way, sort of interviewing my father to see the process that a rabbi has to go through when he counsels people and goes through the mourning process together with people and sort of just go through that process and how it is from his side of the coin, but as well as we'll touch on more general things and lessons for everyone, how to interact with mourners, how to talk to mourners, how to go through mourning yourself, etc. So I want to begin. Obviously, a person called out, just to point out, you do a lot of other things, obviously. You're not someone who just does funerals all day, every day. You're quite busy with other areas of life. But the nature is that when you get to know people, you get to know their families, you get to know them. Inevitably, you're with them in their times of grief as well, and in their times of sadness as well, and you have to walk them through that from the very first moments, sometimes even before the first moments, even before the person passes away, you're there when they pass away, and then you sort of walk them through that entire grieving process. So maybe you just want to describe those initial moments, I guess, sort of the first walk into a home, people just lost someone very, very dear to them. What do you say? What do you do? How do you prepare yourself to do that before we get to the funeral and all that's involved in that?
So good evening, everyone. As you pointed out, it's a little bit of a more somber topic this week. And I want to just, by way of introduction, a couple of different things. First of all, although it's a sadder topic, but it's very much part of the life cycle and it's very much part of the Jewish life cycle, the Jewish process, and the Jewish experience, and therefore it's an important thing to learn and to talk about and to discuss. And I suppose this is the week to do it. If we're going to do it, this is probably the good week to do it. As we know, we're currently in the period in the Jewish calendar called the 9 days. 9 days are the days leading up to Tisha B'Av, which is this coming Sunday, which is probably known as the saddest day of the year. It's the year we mourn the destruction of both temples. It's the year we mourn many national tragedies that took place in Jewish history on the day of Tisha B'Av. Therefore, often this is the time to focus on that part of Jewish learning, I suppose, dealing with challenge or dealing with bereavement and grief, and so on and so forth. That's sort of the introduction number one. Introduction number two. I know you asked me some sort of personal questions, but I don't mind sharing. But it's always a nice part of the shavuos. But I think there's some general concepts for everyone to learn, and I'm going to try and incorporate them as well, because I think that's important. The third thing that's really important is, are you still there? Yeah. The third thing that's really important is that every situation is different. Every circumstance is different. You always hope that as a rabbi, when you get called to help people through their time of sadness, because every time someone passes away, it's a time of great sadness. Every time someone is done well, or every time someone especially passes away, it's always a time of grief, grief for the family, loved ones. To lose loved ones is always a very hard thing. But you hope at least that it fits into the natural process of a life cycle. The person lived a good life, the person was older, and so on and so forth. Of course, it becomes very different when it's an exceptional circumstance where it's a specific tragedy or someone was young and so on and so forth. So that's just, there was no set rules, really. There's no set one size fits all kind of process that you go through. But I suppose I want to just draw some inspiration from what the Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, tells us. The Ethics of the Fathers tells us that Al tenachameu b'shasha matom mutal lefanav. We know that what that means. I'll just give it some context. We know that in the Jewish experience, one of the big mitzvot is to comfort someone in their mourning. And we know that in Jewish ritual, there's even a specific line that we say, Amakom menachem etchem. We wish people that God should comfort them amongst the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem and so on. But yet the Pirkei Avot says that you don't comfort someone, the expression is, at the time when the dead person is still lying there. What it means is right after it's happened. Because as we know in modern psychology, there's a lot spoken about the stages of grief, right? And it's very fascinating that the stages of grief, and from a Jewish perspective, very much, not exactly perhaps, but very much mirrors those stages of grief discussed in modern psychology. But one of the things that is true is that the initial experience is one of shock, and therefore it's one of silence. And sometimes it's not about saying anything. Sometimes when you're with the family at the time of the grief or the time of sudden grief or when it's just happened, it's really about being there, not so much about saying anything. Because often there's really nothing, I mean, you can make up something to say, but there's nothing really to say. Obviously sorry for the loss and all that kind of stuff, but it's about being there. I want to just share with you a little story if I can. Once you ask a personal question, I'll tell you a personal story where I first realized this and saw this. About this concept of being there for someone, not necessarily saying things. Sometimes people think you have to always say something, and sometimes it's the inappropriate thing that comes out. But this concept of being there. So when I was 18, I think it was, my grandmother passed away. Your great grandmother, my Bobas, they call it. And at that time, she wasn't well, and my grandfather, the famous Rabbi Eloy from South Africa, just had an eye operation. And therefore they weren't home, they were staying with us. My father was away, actually I was a bit younger, I was like 16, 17, something like that. And I wasn't used to these things very, very much. And then, you know, my father's parents had passed away, but that was in Israel, so I never really witnessed this firsthand. And my father was away in business and my grandmother collapsed. She went unconscious and the doctor came, they called an ambulance, and my mother went with her to the hospital. And about a half an hour later, my uncle shows up at the door. He says, "Where's Zayda?" I said, "He's in the bedroom." And he goes in and he just said one or two things, and it was right away clear that my grandmother had passed away. And it was a time when my grandfather was very sad. He started to cry. And then suddenly, a few minutes later, a guy shows up, a very, very close friend of the family. And I can even say his name. His name is Kobel Bacher, a very, very special person. In fact, he just lost his wife, unfortunately. And he was a man, generally a very few words. He wasn't a loud guy, but he was a very close friend of the family. And he came and he just stood there. And my mother came back from the hospital and they were making arrangements. And then there was a lot of noise. And he just stood there the whole time. And I remember very, very clearly that like an hour or an hour and a half, 2 hours later, as he was about to leave, my grandfather was much older than him. And my grandfather walked over to him and said, "Koppel, du bist alle Moldova mit Afterhob. And you're always with us when we need you." I remember at the time, not being very experienced, thinking to myself, it's really strange. The guy hasn't said a word all night, hasn't said a word all night. But he was just there. And he was there fully, and he was there with everyone. And that was a source of great strength and comfort. So every situation is different. Obviously, you know, sometimes when you first come, there's questions. You always have to be able to make people comfortable, to feel as many questions, to ask as many questions as they want to, whatever they want. Different people are interested in different things. Some people are interested in the spiritual side of things. What's happening with the soul now? Others just want to cry and not talk about anything. Others want to ask. Other people want to ask specific questions about the laws of mourning. Others want to just ask about the arrangements. Others don't want to ask about anything. So you got to adapt, but it's really just about showing up and being there and not necessarily saying that much. I think you're muted.
Yeah. Okay. So then obviously that then the sort of the next stage is the funeral. As a rabbi, I've been by many funerals that you've sort of
officiated
is the word I'm looking for. It's correct. There's a lot of preparation that goes into that. Now, I mean, the funeral sort of ceremony is standard. I mean, it's not much different than, you know, it's all set in stone. But obviously the eulogy, what we call in Hebrew, the hesped, is unique to every single funeral. And obviously you probably, and I've seen you put a lot of preparation into each one. So first of all, I want to ask you two things about that. So first of all, these two questions are connected. What's the purpose of a eulogy in your mind? In other words, when you sit there and you're preparing a eulogy for someone, what are you trying to achieve? Who are you trying to please? What are you trying to gain from that? Is giving a eulogy just a thing that people do? Is it a Jewish thing? If so, what's the origin of it? What's the purpose of it in the sort of the Jewish point of view? And that's more the philosophical side of it. And then the more practical side of it, what's the process? How do you prepare that? How do you decide what to say? What's involved in all of that?
Okay, so let's start from the beginning. So the concept of a hesped, the concept of a eulogy is very, very, comes from a very, very early source. In fact, it's in the Chumash. When our matriarch Sarah passed away, she actually passed away when Avraham Avinu wasn't there. He had taken Yitzchak to the Akedah, to the binding of the Isaac. He came back and Sarah had passed away. And the Torah says, Ayavo Avraham came, lispod l'sarah v'lifkotah, to eulogize Sarah and to cry for her. Now, we'll talk about the concept of crying, I guess, a little bit later when we talk about the Shiva thing, but both things are important. So he came to eulogize her and to cry for her. Crying for a person who's passed away is important. It's part of the mourning and grieving process. But apparently saying eulogy is and it's an ancient Jewish custom. We find it all over the Talmud. We find this concept of eulogy. Now, the purpose of eulogy is interesting because it's, I think, evolved a bit in different communities in different ways. Some people sort of in the more modern time and the more sort of modern communities, I think it's taken more as a tribute to the person who passed away. And that's certainly part of it from a Jewish perspective also, to highlight the greatness of the person that passed away, to learn from the legacy, to point out the things that we can learn from the person. King Solomon says, a famous verse, when someone passes away, those that remain alive should take to heart, they should reflect. And one of the biggest things you can do for the soul of the person that is departed is you can actually learn from their good traits, learn from their amazing qualities, learn from the legacy that they've left. But interestingly enough, it's also, in the Talmud, the concept of a hesper, the concept of a eulogy, in a way connected to what it says about Abraham, because he came to eulogize her and to cry for her, is actually a process where people would give eulogies in such a way where actually it would arouse crying, it would arouse the mourning, and it was supposed to support and help people express grief and express crying, which is an important part from a Jewish perspective, right? Which is why, actually, interestingly enough, that the Talmud and Jewish law actually highlights certain days that you're not supposed to eulogize people. For example, on Rosh Chodesh, you're not supposed to eulogize. On Hanukkah, on Purim, on certain special days, days that are more happy, days of happiness, although we do have funerals and we do grieve, but you're supposed to minimize it a bit, and if you don't eulogize. And it's interesting what that means, because obviously the eulogy is there to make people cry, in a way, to actually evoke feelings, right? Today, often the custom is, especially in Mormon communities, that in days that you're not supposed to eulogize someone, the rabbi will say, today is Rosh Chodesh, so we're not really supposed to eulogize, so we'll just say a few brief words. Kind of, it's a funny sort of way of getting a loophole kind of thing. What that really means is that we'll try and stay away from things which are very, just more stick to the facts and still stick to the history and more as a tribute to the person, rather than being something that should arouse feelings of mourning and feelings of sadness more than already there, right? So that's the, so I think it's got a number of things. So it's, and it's supposed to be a hesped among many communities, among in very, very religious communities, considered something that is good for the soul, good for the mourners, and it's a good thing all around. And again, learn from the Chumash, learn from the Talmud. Interestingly enough, there are some communities, not many, Chabad actually is one of them, that do not say eulogies, at least not at the funeral. One of the ideas behind it is that in case the person who eulogizes will exaggerate the person's qualities, that is considered something that's not so good for the soul. And therefore, kind of you stay away from it. And therefore, the custom developed in some Hasidic communities not to eulogize at all. What happens afterwards is that they have memorial prayers or memorial ceremonies, and people do tell stories about the person and so on. And that kind of substitutes the process of eulogizing or accomplishes the concept of a eulogy or a hesped. So there's different components to it. So I guess that also leads into your next question, that when you prepare the eulogy, obviously you have in mind the person who's passed away and you try and capture it, but also you want to strengthen the people who are mourning. That's part of the process, right? You want to strengthen those people, and therefore you try to get a bit of a sense about what they want, which I guess leads into your other question, is how do you prepare one? Now it's interesting, in my own personal experience, the preparing eulogy is divides into two categories. There's the people who I actually knew them well and the people I didn't know. Often I'm very close to people, but I don't know that well, at least the relative that has passed away. So I'm therefore, my being there is more the family, but not so much the person who passed away, right? So we all try our best, I suppose. What I normally do is I make a point of doing something which takes a bit of time, but I think is really important. I make a time to sit with the family. Normally when I say sit with family, often it's children, it's in-laws, it's grandchildren, it's extended family. And I just take notes. I ask them just to speak about the person, speak about the things you would want me to say. I mean, not always is possible. Sometimes there's sometimes there's a person passed away and the funeral is like a few hours later, and that becomes difficult, but normally it's the next day. And it's, first of all, it's normally, I find it a very beneficial session, because what happens is, first of all, it's quite cathartic. People actually are able to speak and they find it very beneficial to reminisce and to bring up all those memories and to sort of let out all those emotions. What I do is I just take a lot of notes as they're speaking, and I try to sort of ask a few questions and get it. And then I go back home and I put it all together. I try to put it back and I try as best I can to capture the person from the things that I've heard. And normally the things I've heard at that time are very good, because they're real and they're sincere. They're kind of people who are in the mourning process, they're grieving, and they're just really emotional, and they talk about the things in a very sincere and deep way. And it makes it easier sometimes to capture the person and their characteristics and their personality. Often people, and then of course, you know, you try and connect it to something inspirational, something for the parasha of the week, something, based on what they've said, a lesson that we can learn from them. So you put all the information you have from the family in context, and you weave it together with something that is meaningful and perhaps inspirational, or hopefully inspirational. I guess that's more or less how it works.
What's your view about putting jokes in a eulogy? Have you ever done that? Is that a Jewish thing to do? Because it is a thing definitely out there. I just wonder if that's a Jewish sort of.
I guess everyone has their personality. I normally don't. I just never thought it sort of fits into the moment. Everything has its place and time. Although I must say, I mean, it all depends what, you know, it all depends on the family. I mean, it all depends what the feelings of the people are. Sometimes they tell me things that are a bit funny that they specifically want me to include, and I will include it respectfully and nicely. I don't like when it becomes like a, I mean, I must tell you to go to a completely different cycle of life. I don't tell that many jokes under a chuppah either. Because actually, although a wedding is a very joyous occasion, and if I guess I don't have such a good sense of humor, but I mean, if I had a good joke at a wedding reception, I would tell it, but at a chuppah, chuppah is also a serious time. I think serious times need to be serious times. They're different kind of serious, but I try to capture the moment as best I can. But if family have a nice little cute, funny story about the person and really want it included, I think it's okay. Then lightens up the moment a little bit. And again, it depends on the situation. But as a general rule, you probably wouldn't call me the rabbi that puts jokes into eulogies, generally speaking.
Okay. This is a more also, we'll get into more general things later on, how it applies to everyone else. But as a question, this is more of a question for a rabbi. When you're going through this journey with people, in the professional world, like by therapists and things like that, there's this concept of professional distance. I'm not sure if that's the legal correct term for it, but that's the idea. The idea of keeping sort of a little bit of a, boundaries, a distance, you don't get too emotionally involved. Do you find yourself, do you think it's necessary? Where do you see the role of a rabbi in all of this? Do you mourn along with them? Do you just guide them, but sort of keep emotionally distant? How would you describe that?
So it's a very interesting question there, because I think it depends, any rabbi would do all kinds of different funerals or eulogies and so on like that. I mean, sometimes there are people I really don't even know that well. They don't have a rabbi, so I'll get called, I know someone that knows them. And so I suppose, to be honest, I mean, you don't know the people very well. You're not that close to them. You're as respectful and as empathetic as you can be. But to say that you get emotionally involved is probably a little bit over-exaggerated, because you don't even know them. But then you have people who you're very close to, people that you are have feel for them, right? You're not just a clinician that they've come to. You're not just a professional they've come to. So there's a very interesting balance and there's been a few cases where that's been a little bit of a struggle, because maybe more tragic situations and people very, very well. And on the one end, I don't think professional listening is such a good thing. I think a rabbi, especially if they know the people well, is a person who's there, you connected to them, right? I often think about my own grandfather who did many funerals and many weddings, and he had a unique ability that when people who he knew and who part of his following were going through a challenging time, it was like he went through it as well. When people had a simcha, it was like his simcha, right? Having said that, of course, you need to have a certain level of strength. I don't think it's I think the word distance is probably the wrong word, but hopefully it's not distance. But you do need to have a certain amount of strength, because when you, and not only death, this is a lot of times people are going through challenging times. And I will sometimes come home after a day of dealing with people that were going through terrible pain. It happened last week, actually, where you're exhausted and you're drained because it's really hard and you feel. But at the same time, when you're with people, there's a certain strength that you have to have, because they're looking to you for support. So you're not much good if you fall apart together with them. So I think that's that balance. On the one hand, you're actually much more effective if you feel with them and for them and together with them, and it's sincere. On the other hand, you need to maintain not distance, but strength, because your role is to support. And if you need to fall apart, then you need to fall apart later. A few years ago, I went through, I'm not going to go through the details, of course, but I supported a family through an incredibly tragic situation. It was very new for me. I felt very, very pained and saddened with them and for them, and went through it. And actually, it was the one time that, I mean, someone suggested I should do this, but I just thought, I better actually just make sure I'm okay. I went for counseling. I don't think I needed that, but I just went to check in with someone just to check on myself, kind of thing, just to make sure. And the people do that. I know that in the professional world, they do that. That was called supervision and stuff. But, right, so I just went to do that just to make sure that I went to reflect if I went through it correctly and if I helped them correctly. And just went to someone who I know very well, but is a professional, just to sort of get his take. He thought I was doing fine, but it was something that I really needed to do. But at the same time, while I was with them, I tried to be very strong, because I needed to really help them and support them.
Mm. Sure. This is an interesting question. So obviously, you've been doing this for many, many years. I assume that I hope anyway that you don't do it the same way now that you did it 30 years ago. Generally in life, you try to grow and you try to, did you ever make any mistakes in the process? I mean, it's a very sort of, as you said, it's very delicate. Every situation is different. You have to know what to say, when to say it, how to say it. What are things that you've learned from? What are things that you've changed throughout this whole process?
That's funny you say that. When I first started out as a rabbi, I remember very well the first funeral I did, and then I had no idea what I was doing, to be honest. I tried my best, but so I don't have right now in my mind a specific mistake, although I'm sure I made plenty. But yes, learning, yes, doing things better, knowing when to say what, knowing when to come, knowing when to show up, when knowing how to show up. Learned through, definitely, hopefully gotten better, and will continue, hopefully. I mean, we always grow, right? I think that's a part of all life, that one has to always reflect and do things better and see how you can always improve. I think that's a general rule in life, and doing these things, although you try your best at the time, and I think people appreciate and they know that you're trying with, you know, you're trying the best that you can, but at the same time, it's certainly important to keep reflecting. And I do. Often I reflect on what I've done, and I come back from a process and I do think about it. And I thought, what could I have done better? How could I have helped them better, strengthened them better? Sometimes I feel I haven't done enough and I can't put my finger in it, and I think about it later and hopefully try and work it out. But yeah, we keep on doing. Sometimes I watch others and see the way they do it and think, is that a good thing to do? Not a good thing to do? Is that a good way to do it? Not a good way to do it? You know, I try and sort of educate myself and learn all the time.
Okay. So obviously the next stage afterwards is the Shiva process, which you're also involved in, but that's already a stage where not only you're involved in, but everyone else is also actively involved in. People come to visit, people come to make a Shiva call, or they come to comfort the mourners, to a minyan, or just throughout the day. So I want to ask a two-part question. First of all, just if you can give it sort of a general, and these two things are connected again, it's more the philosophy and the practicality. What's the source of Shiva? What's the purpose of Shiva, number one? And what do you think people do wrong when they come to a Shiva house? I can't recall the name of the book. For some reason, I don't know why, I read this book when I was quite young. It was lying around our house. I can't remember what it's called now. It's written by a woman who lost her husband very tragically. And she writes a book, something to the effect of what you shouldn't and should say when you come to the Shiva house. That's not the title. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I
can't remember what it's called. It's a brilliant book, and it's I don't know why I read it then or why I was reading it, but it made a big impact on me, because it's like the things people say, and no one has bad intentions. I don't think people come, you know, let me make this person feel bad. I think people only have good intentions, but good intentions are not always good outcomes. And the question is, and this is quite a broad and long question, because what do you think people get wrong when they come to a Shiva house?
Okay, so this is an evolved question. So first of all, let's go through the process. I want to actually take a step back, if you don't mind. There's two parts. When someone loses a loved one, there's actually two parts. Like you said, the Shiva starts after the burial. And one of the reasons, first of all, it's part of the stages of grieving. Initially, the shock, there's no Shiva, it's more silence. But also there's another reason, and I think people sometimes forget this, and I'll point it out because I think it's an important thing to point out. I pointed out in the past, but I'll point it out again. Up until the burial, the focus is not actually so much on the family. The focus is on the person that passed away, right? And to give them, in Jewish thinking, in Jewish learning, the kavod, the honor, the respect, the dignity that's given to someone that's passed away, both body and soul, is very detailed, very prescriptive, and very important, right? I'll give you an example. You know, sometimes, and no one means bad, of course, no one judging anyone, but sometimes people forget this. For example, they go to a funeral. I know it happens here, particularly when it happens at the chevra, just the way it's structured. So often, you know, when the service is over, the coffin is carried out into the car, and the car moves a little bit. The point of that is to give people opportunity of accompanying the deceased, which is a very big mitzvah. It's called levaya. The word funeral in Hebrew is levaya, which means to accompany. And often what happens is people actually don't. The car goes off with a couple of rabbis. They're saying a few chapters of verses, and everyone's milling around and sort of talking to the family is actually incorrect. Really, what should be happening is everyone should be following the car, following the hearse, because at that moment, actually, the real focus is actually on the person who's deceased and not the family. But then, once the person is buried, then the process of mourning begins. Now, the process of mourning is a process, first of all, that's written about in the Talmud. Its origin is in the Chumash itself. We learn it from Yitzhak when Avraham Avinu passed away and so on and so forth. And it's supposed to be a very prescriptive and detailed process of expressing grief. It's designed to give those who mourn an opportunity to express emotion, to process the grief. And it goes in stages. It says the first 3 days are much more intense. Then it goes the 7 days. Then we get up and we move on and we go to the Shloshim and so on and so forth. Everyone grieves in a different way, and everyone is supported in a different way. So there are halachot, there are laws which are very prescriptive, which force a person into focusing on their grief. Excuse me. Because the Talmud says, and the commentaries explain, that God designed the person with emotions, and emotions are a very important part of the person. And some of those emotions in these kind of situations are very painful, and therefore a person is supposed to process those emotions. Grief is a very important thing. Crying is a very important thing. Some people sometimes, you know, they don't want to cry, especially in public. I always tell people it's okay to cry. It's okay not to have a bad day. It's okay. It's going to be a roller coaster of emotion, and it's okay to have really low moments, right? And the purpose of the people coming is to support those going through the grief. It's to give them strength, to give them comfort, right? I'll just share with you a fascinating law. I think we've talked about it before, maybe, but there's a fascinating halacha, which is hard to keep in a way practically, but it symbolizes an amazing thing. Halacha says that when you go to a house of mourning, and you sit down in front of a mourner, you're actually not supposed to start speaking before they do. They're supposed to speak first. One of the ideas behind that is an amazing thing, because you don't know what they're in the mood of talking about. Do they want to talk about the person who passed away? Do they want to talk about the weather? Just they've had a break. They've gone through a very intense few hours. They just need a break, a distraction. Do they want to just talk about anything? They want to not talk, right? You need to gauge what they want to do, right? And that's why you have to let them talk first, so you can pick up the mood. You can pick up the temperature in the air. You can pick up the vibe of what's going on, so you can see, right? Now, sometimes just the way it happens, it's not such a bad thing. Sometimes like shiva houses become like a party house. Like everyone comes and are socializing and talking to. It's not 100% appropriate. Really should be, people should be just more somber, be focusing on those people. But I think here's the point, and I think this is the main idea. And the truth is, this is not only about a shiva house, what I'm about to say, because it goes to your next question. It's really important, you know, chesed, kindness in a Jewish context is so important. So we have all these mitzvot of kindness, comforting a mourner, visiting a sick, giving charity to those that need, and so on and so forth. It's always critical to bear in mind that the purpose of all these ideas is for the purpose of the person who you're doing it for. It's not for you to feel good. It's not for you to have a checklist that you've checked off that you've done it, right? And therefore, it's really important to gauge what am I doing that's going to be good for the person, right? And therefore, a person has to ask themselves some questions. Like you go in the middle of the day, you can see the person is tired. Don't hang around there for an hour and a half, right? The person might be polite. A mourner sitting shiver maybe needs a break. They need to eat something. You want to show you care? Pop in for a few minutes. You can gauge your own level of closeness. How close are you to that person? Right? If you're very close to that person, you stay longer, you're a greater support. If you're not, sometimes you know you're not that close to the person, but it will be just a beautiful gesture and a real respectful thing to pop in. But you pop in and you start having a whole schmooze. Sometimes you become a burden to that person. This person is not that close to you. You don't have such a close relationship, so he's got to now entertain you kind of thing, and he's got to keep the conversation going, and don't do that. Same thing, you know, you go visit someone that's in the hospital, make sure what you're saying is beneficial. Make sure that the questions you ask is beneficial. Make sure the time you spent there is beneficial. The person might be really tired. They just need a breath. Show you care. Show up for a minute if you need to, or show up for longer. But give thought to what is appropriate. Unfortunately, the book you read is a tragic thing, because it's actually a real thing. And I've heard from people that sit shiva and go through this process, that sometimes people say things that are ridiculous. They give advice, or they, like, are you sure you had the right doctors, or you know, did you try this? Right? I mean, it's not relevant anymore. The person died, right? And all kinds of crazy things, and you know, things about the person, and things about, just like inappropriate, and can sometimes be hurtful. I always say showing up means you're caring. If you're not sure if the thing you're going to say is right or appropriate or strengthening, don't say it. Because saying less is not going to take away. You still care. You're still there. So be careful. And again, it doesn't only go for shiva. It goes for anything that we do. You know, even giving someone something, you know, you might, you know, sometimes person's not well, and we send the flowers, or we send, you know, they might need something else. You think, what does that person need? What does that person need me to say? What does that person need me to give them? How does that person need me to show up? And what's good for them? Not what's good for me, or what I think is the right thing. What's right for them?
It's hard though. Sometimes it's like it's very, it can be very awkward. It's unfortunately quite a. Like, would you say most people know what they're doing, or most people don't know? Like, what would the...
Look, I'll tell you something else. That's very interesting, and I've heard this from people, right? Sometimes when people suffer a loss, particularly in a much more tragic situation, I've heard from people, and I've read about this as well, people tell me that for weeks afterwards, they kind of suddenly, people they thought were friendly to them, they disappear. And it's very hurtful. And the reason they disappear is because they actually don't know what to say, and they're scared, right? Like, it can be very awkward or very tragic, and they don't know what to say, so they don't show up. And that's why I say, again, it's the same thing. Like, you don't need to say a lot. It's not necessary to say so much. I mean, sometimes it is, sometimes not, but just show you care, just like check in, you know? And let me sort of add to this also, that sometimes the shiva is very overwhelming, because especially big families and a lot of friends. Sometimes also about checking in, and we don't, you know, all of us perhaps don't do this enough. You know, sometimes after the shiva, it all finishes, and then life goes back to normal for everyone else, and for the people, it doesn't. They're still mourning. Sometimes it's good just to give a quick phone call, you know. It doesn't have to be a nudgy phone call, that you don't have to nag. I'm just checking in to see how you are. You know, also you have to, sometimes you call someone that's going through a really tough time, and everyone knows they're going through a really tough time. And like, how you start the conversation is also hard. Like, you say, so-and-so, it's Michal Gerari. How are you? How are you? Sometimes it's a stupid question. What do I mean, how are you? The guy's not doing too well, right? Sometimes you just think about those little things. Like, how are you? It's like, how are you doing? Or how are you coping? Or just checking in to see how you're going, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Also things like, never compare. Never say, like, I understand. Understand you must be going through a hard time. You don't understand because you're not going through it. Every morning is different. Every grief is different, right?
Talking of which, this is an interesting question. Like, you've been there for others a lot. You've been through mourning yourself. Your father passed away. You had a brother who passed away. How did that, let me ask you this two ways, actually. Did being there for others help you? Sort of, were there things that you knew before? And also, did something change how you relate to others? Like, did you sort of use your own experience to help others?
Well, I think so. I mean, when you go through something yourself, obviously you understand other people, you know, not understand, but you're able to relate to other people's pain in a different way. And that's part of becoming, you know, as I become older, I don't necessarily become cleverer, but I've gone through more life experiences, and obviously you go through your own experiences, so you kind of relate to other people better, maybe in a deeper way. But also I got to experience and to strengthen and to enforce certain things that I've been telling you. Like, I remember when I was sitting shiva with my father in South Africa. So it was, one, it was very beautiful that people came. I found it very strengthening and very comforting. On the hand, there were people that used to do exactly the things I'm telling you not to do. Like, they would come and just sit there and like just be a nudnik. And sometimes you think to yourself, like, I really had enough of this. Could you just go? Like, and you know, you kind of, it's draining. And it was clear that some people just don't get it, and it's a problem. But those exceptions. I mean, by and large, people were amazing, and they were caring, and it was an experience to be in the situation where you're on the receiving end of people's kindness. And it is quite amazing.
Okay. By the way, if anyone has any questions, please feel free to put it in the chat. This is more of a philosophical question. Obviously, the natural reaction of a person who loses a loved one is sadness and mourning and grief. How does that work philosophically? I mean, we know that we trust in God, that God does everything for the best, and we know even in fact by the funeral we even make a blessing called Dayan HaEmes, acknowledging that Hashem is the true judge and He knows what He's doing. Have you ever found, let me ask it this way, have you ever found people feeling guilty that they feel sad? Does that make sense? In other words, how do you explain to someone, particularly someone who's very devout, sort of very committed, that it's okay to feel the tragedy, even though you believe that everything's for the best?
That's a very deep philosophical question. So the idea, so faith is a very, very big foundation of the Jewish experience, right? But faith is not a contradiction to pain. Evident by the fact that God commanded us to feel pain. He commanded us to mourn, right? He gave us emotions. He sometimes gives us things which are challenging, painful, and being in denial of the pain, even if that denial comes from faith, is not a good thing. It's not a healthy thing. That's why crying is important. Grieving is important, right? But it's grieving in the context of faith. I mean, one of the most amazing things is that even in the most tragic of circumstances, when people lose a loved one, even in very, very tragic circumstances, the thing you do, as you say, number one, you make a blessing. You tear a piece of clothing to enforce the pain, to highlight the pain, and yet you make a bracha, acknowledging that God is the ultimate judge. And what do we do for the soul? What do mourners do? They say Kaddish, right? And Kaddish has nothing to do with the soul, as we know. People always think Kaddish is for the soul. Yeah, it elevates the soul, but it doesn't talk about the soul. It talks about God and belief in God and exalting God's name. Yitkadal v'yitkadash merabah means to maybe great and sanctify God's name, right? Because this is the power of a Jew. The power of a Jew is even in extreme painful circumstances to be able to say, but I have a soul and I'm connected to God and I believe in God. When I say I believe in God, it doesn't mean I understand God, especially in those kind of circumstances. I don't, right? So belief doesn't mean understanding, nor are we supposed to try and understand. And by the way, if I can go back, not only to loss of loved ones or death, but even in other challenges, right? Even in circumstances where I've been at families or in houses and people ask me questions and they say, why? Like, why, right? I never, ever answer those questions. Because first of all, during those times, at that time, questions are coming from the heart and answers come from the brain, and it doesn't match. And also, I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. Just because I'm the one supporting, so I'm in the role of being the supporter, I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer why God does things that are very painful and challenging. I believe God has a plan. God knows what He's doing. I accept it. And our challenge is not even now. The answer to the question we should never explore, even later necessarily, right? Because God doesn't want us to justify the things that He does that are painful. He wants us to believe in Him. He wants us to accept Him. And He wants us eventually, in time, and when the right time comes around, right, to give it meaning. And that's why there's a process of, just like there's an important process of sitting Shiva, there's also an important process of moving on, getting up from Shiva, moving to the next stage, and eventually becoming strong, and doing things which are constructive, doing things for the neshama, doing things for the soul that are beneficial, that are inspiring, giving it meaning, giving it some purpose. They're never necessarily answering the question why, but even that is not supposed to be there right in the beginning. Right in the beginning, there's faith. Yeah, Kaddish is faith. I accept it as faith. At a funeral, there's a thing we say called Tziduk Hadin, where we proclaim Hashem gives and Hashem takes, and let the name of God be blessed, right? We read a story in the Chumash where Aaron's Moses' brother Aaron's sons were tragically taken on the day that the Mishkan was established, and it was a time of great joy, and yet it was a great tragedy. But Moshe Rabbeinu made a comment to Aaron, and Aaron says, "Vayidom Aaron." Aaron was silent. He accepted. He didn't say. He didn't question, and he didn't answer. He didn't do either. He just was silent. There's a time for silence. It's a loud silence, but it's silence, right? And that's the strength, and that's the sort of perspective we have to try and give. Even when this question, I don't know the answer. I can help people, I can strengthen people to try and accept and believe and to know that God is with them. And in fact, the Talmud tells us that God is with them in their pain, which is an interesting thing. That's an interesting concept. I suppose the analogy we have for it maybe is when a father does something to a child that he thinks is for the benefit of the child, even though it's painful, the father still has pain. He doesn't like to see his child suffering, right? But the Talmud says that. I mean, this is very connected to the time of year that we're in. We mourn the destruction of the temple. The destruction of the temple wasn't just the destruction of a building. It was a time of great persecution of the Jewish people. It was a tragic destruction of headquarters of Jewish spirituality and so on and so forth. And God did it to us, and he sent us into exile. And he was one that did it. Yet the Talmud says that every single day God cries for the fact that he destroyed the temple. And he's asking us to make sure it's rebuilt because he wants us to do certain things. But he also is with us in his pain. So that's how it fits in. And I think, you know, that's as a Jew, that's what we try and do. We try and marry the two things together. We're able to feel pain, but we should never feel guilty about feeling pain. Because feeling pain is real, to the pain is real. At the same time, we can say, and it's God's will, and I acknowledge that.
All right. We'll end off with one question, one more question, which is a very broad question. You have to sort of narrow it down to some key points. But if anyone else has any questions, please feel free to comment. What advice do you have to mourners? I know it's a very, very general question, and it can be on many, many levels. So I'll just throw it out there, and you can do whatever you want with it. What advice do you have to people who are actually going through this?
Look, again, I think everyone's a different circumstance, but there's a couple of key things that I think is important. First of all, it's okay, and it's not only mourners, again, like a lost loved one, it's any extreme challenge. First of all, it's okay not to be okay. You don't have to be strong. People sometimes think it's a strength to be strong. I've got to be strong. I've got to be here. I've got to put on a show. I've got to be strong for others. Yeah, sometimes we have to be strong for other people, but at the same time, it's okay to fall apart. It's okay to cry. It's okay to feel down. It's all those things, all those range of emotions are all okay. That's number one. What's not okay is to remain that way, which again, I said that's built into the whole process. That's why we have this concept. You know, there's a custom that when people finish sitting shiva, there's a formal process of asking them to stand up. Like you say, get up. The idea is that we support them to move on to the next stage. But the first stage is important. And during that stage, it's okay not to be okay. And I think people often, you know, some people find it very hard to cry and very hard to show emotion. And of course, it ranges from person to person. Some people are more emotional than others, and that's fine. And people grieve in different ways. But it's okay not to be okay. It's all right. It's just not okay to remain that way, right? Number one. Number two, never do it alone. The process is there for a reason, and the process involves other people. You hope other people will do the right thing, but reach out, and it's okay. It's okay to be, you know, vulnerable at that stage. It's okay to you know, we some people only want to, you know, I've been by shiva houses. You know, everyone has different personalities. There are certain people that never take. They're allergic to taking, so they're always giving. And you find that even in their time of grief, they always want to give. They always want to, you know, I had to tell someone, you know, you don't get up when someone comes into the house. You actually remain sitting. And you don't see people to the door, and you don't sort of make them a cup of tea. You don't do anything because this is your time to take, because God made the world in a way we'll be given, we receive. Mashpia and makabel. And although, yes, it's true, the Rambam tells us that the greater way to be, especially financially, is to be on the giving end rather than the receiving end. And being a taker is not normally a nice thing, but God created the world to be a world of chesed. Chesed means the world of kindness. Kindness requires a giver and a receiver, right? And we all go through times, even people whose job and whose role it is to always give and to always help and to always support, they also need to know that sometimes they need to be on the receiving end. They need to be able to take help from people. They need to take support from people. They need other people sometimes as well. We all need people at some stage. So therefore, I guess that's the key advice. It's okay not to be okay. Secondly, it's important not to do it alone, not to be strong and a hero and a martyr, but actually to reach out, let people support you. Thirdly, I would say as time goes along, to always take something tangible to do in honor of the person. Channel the emotions, not right away, and don't jump into it right away because that's not the time for it. There's a time to grieve. But then afterwards, process it and channel it and translate into something tangible. Throughout the year, we have this concept of learning for the soul of the person, giving tzedakah for the soul of the person, doing things in memory, helping an organization, whatever it might be, but translating something tangible, because number one, we believe that people down here below are able to support the journey of the soul. Because what we didn't talk about at length, and it's not one part of the discussion really, is just like the mourners go through a journey, the soul also does. And sometimes it's a painful journey. And part of the idea of Kaddish and doing things for the neshama and so on, part of that is also the idea of supporting the soul in its journey. So therefore, that's one of the benefits, that throughout the year when we do things for the person, like Kaddish and mitzvot and good things, we support the journey of the soul, but also it's comforting and strengthening for the mourner themselves. So I guess those are the three things. Besides obviously following the process, but it's okay not to be okay, reach out for help, get support, and with time, channel it into tangible things in support of the person, support of the soul.
All right. Okay, a bit of a heavy topic today. Wish everyone should only celebrate together Simchas, happy things. Please God, we'll continue this shmooze over the next few weeks. Seems like we're going to be in the situation for the next few weeks. We have some exciting guests, hopefully, that we're going to be having. So you won't become bored of just me and my father. We'll try to spice it up a little bit. Some exciting topics, some exciting guests. And hope to see you next time and join all the other shurim and all the other classes happening. Have a wonderful night, everyone.